The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Last Wednesday, Bubbla hosted a debate in Stockholm in cooperation with the Marxist Humanist Initiative. And this week's podcast is a recording of that debate between libertarian economist Pierre Byland and Marxist economist Andrew Kleiman. It's Wednesday, September 21st, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. And I'm proud to have a chance to share this debate on our podcast feed. Before I cut to the debate, I want to thank Zero Book Club members and encourage listeners who haven't signed up as members to do so. This Friday's Members Only Inside Zero Books podcast will feature a conversation with Ashley Frowley, who is the author of the book Semiotics of Happiness and a member of the Zero Books editorial team. Here's a clip from that upcoming Members Only conversation. What I hear from people on the right when they're talking about this is that the problem is affluence, technology, and soft parenting, not, you know, which is the opposite from, you know, what you just described. But we coddle these kids, we try to raise their self-esteem, we give awards for everything, and then they have these expectations that they're going to be, that their feelings are all that matter, and they enter into the world and they make these ridiculous demands and, you know, are wrecking our institutions, and Western civilization is on the verge of collapse.
I find that interesting that you said that that's kind of like a right-wing thing. I think a lot of people were really affected by that that paper – or not that paper, that article that went viral, The Coddling of the American Mind. And they also blamed parenting. And I found that rich because who was it that scared parents out of disciplining their children? It was partially an industry of you know, self-styled experts. Well, it's got a long, long history, obviously, going back to Freud and so on. But there's a whole class of experts who scared the crap out of parents that anything that you do is going to damage your kids. So you need to be very, very careful. And it's funny because, you know, even I, like, it's my job to point out what nonsense a lot of this is. And I've just had a baby, and I can't help but feel terrified that I'm not stimulating her enough, and she's not going to be smart because I'm not talking. Is she hearing the right amount of words every day? And is she going to be left behind? Because, you know, this amazing kind of paranoia that grows up around parenting, and it's not caused by silly parents. It's caused by sort of a broader sort of cultural framework of parental determinism, which says that whatever parents do to their children condemns them for life.
Just if you're worried about the kid not hearing enough language, just move the crib in front of the TV, turn it on, give them some Coca-Cola, and try not to blow smoke in their face, and they'll be fine. The music you're listening to is Dr. Cameron from the soundtrack of Steven Soderbergh's film Schizopolis. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to a debate between Marxism and libertarianism.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's debate between Professors Andrew Kleiman and Per Byland on what makes a free society. Andrew Kleiman is Professor Emeritus of Economics at Pace University in New York, author of The Failure of Capitalist Production, Underlying Causes of the Great Recession, and Reclaiming Marx's Capital, A Refutation of the Myth of Inconsistency. His research on Marx's theory of value and economic crisis has appeared widely in both academic journals and popular publications. Politically, he works with Marxist Humanist Initiative and is a frequent contributor to its web journal, With Sober Senses. Per Bieland is Assistant Professor of Entrepreneurship and Richards Johnson Professor of Free Enterprise School of Entrepreneurship, Oklahoma State University. Author of The Seen, The Unseen, and The Unrealized, How Regulations Affect Our Everyday Lives and the Problem of Production, A New Theory of the Firm, as well as a regular contributor of articles and op-eds for the Mises Institute, the leading source for Austrian and free market economics worldwide. We're very happy and honored to have such a huge turnout, both physically and online. So if you're not here, but instead see me on YouTube, please remember to click like and subscribe. Since you're going to be watching this for about 2 hours, you might as well do so right away. This event is a joint collaboration between Marxist Humanist Initiative and Bubla. Marxist Humanist Initiative is an international organization based on the philosophy of Karl Marx, as further developed by Raya Donayevskaya's Marxist Humanism. It holds that working people's emancipation from capitalist exploitation and oppression must be their own act. It works to forge a new unity of philosophy and organization in which mass movements striving for freedom lay hold of Marx's philosophy of revolution and recreate society on its basis. For more information on MHI and Marxist Humanism, approach Ravi over there at the book table during the break or after the debate, or on our website at MarxistHumanistInitiative.org. Bubla is an alternative media outlet run by libertarians. The goal of the project is to be a counterweight of statist and left-wing bias in mainstream media. Among other things, Bubla runs several news aggregators and a popular news commentary podcast, Radio Bubla. Founded in 2014, Bubla is created by hundreds of volunteers and since 2016 has an English language sibling project called Corax. For more information, please talk to Martin, where are you? He's over there. So talk to him also at the break or after the debate. The proceedings will be as follows. Each speaker will be given 15 minutes for opening remarks. The speakers will then receive 10 minutes each for responses. We will then take a short 10-minute break, after which we will take questions from the audience for a total of 30 minutes. Our speakers will then get 7.5 minutes each for closing statements. The first part of the debate will be moderated by me. My name is Emmanuel Kamlin, and I'm the co-organizer for this event. And the second will be moderated by Sophia Arkestal, co-organizer and co-founder of Bubla. So, without further ado, we will now begin the debate. Make sure to switch your mobile phones to vibrate only, or preferably turning them off completely. All right, Professor Kleiman, you have 15 minutes for your opening statement. You may start when you wish.
Okay, thank you, Emmanuel. Hello to Anne back in New York, and thank you all for coming. As Emmanuel mentioned, I work with Marxist Humanist Initiative, which is an organization rooted in the Marxist Humanist philosophy of Raya Donayevskaya. In her first major book, Marxism and Freedom, which was published in the middle of the Cold War, Donayevskaya wrote that, quote, on both sides of the Iron Curtain, there is a veritable conspiracy to identify Marxism, a theory of liberation, with its opposite, communism, the theory and practice of enslavement. This book aims to reestablish Marxism in its original form, which Marx called a thoroughgoing naturalism or humanism. Okay, now I want to talk a bit about Marx's idea of freedom. In his view, quote, freedom is so much the essence of man that even its opponents realize it. No man fights freedom. He fights at most the freedom of others. Every kind of freedom has therefore always existed, only at one time as a special privilege, another time as a universal right. I think that's correct. So what we're debating this evening is not whether we want freedom, but freedom for whom? Marx stood for a society in which the full and free development of every individual forms the ruling principle. An association in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. Not because I said so, I was quoting him. This evening's debate is also about what kinds of freedom we are talking about. Now, libertarians such as Tibor McCann, who recently passed away, often seek to define freedom as absence of restraints imposed by other people. And that, I think, is an important aspect of freedom. But there's also freedom from being dominated by the laws of nature because we don't understand them and can't cope well with them. Now, I think there's been a great deal of progress, especially during the last several centuries, in human beings freeing ourselves from domination by nature. And capitalism has also weakened restraints imposed by other people. The problem is that there is yet another important kind of freedom. Freedom from being dominated by economic laws over which we have no control. In Marxism and Freedom, the same book, Rydenevskaya quoted a coal miner. Keep in mind that coal mining is life-threatening work. The miner said, quote, "I can't word it like Marx, but I know exactly what he means. I lay there this morning, about a quarter to six. I said to myself, you've just got to get up there and go down into the mine, whether you feel like it or not. I just said to myself, now you call that a free man?" Okay. Now, capitalism more or less replaced unfreedom imposed by other people, imposed by the slave, imposed on the slave by the slave owner, or imposed on the serf by the landlord. It replaced that with unfreedom imposed by the economic laws of capitalism. You don't have to work under this particular slave owner or that particular feudal lord. Nobody's holding a gun to your head, and you're free to starve to death. But if people don't choose to starve to death, the vast majority of them have to work under the domination of some capitalist. If they disobey or don't live up to the boss's expectations, or they get laid off in a recession, they're free to find yet another master to toil under. It's like being transferred from one prison to another, except that the worker, rather than the state, has to pay the transportation costs. Now, this isn't really the fault of any particular individual capitalist or corporation. They're just agents of the system. They're also dominated by its laws. If they continue to employ people who've become expendable in a recession, or people who don't generate enough profit for the company, they're likely going to go out of business. And so the capitalists that remain capitalists are the ones that dutifully obey the economic laws of capitalism. So what is at fault is the system. Now, it's not as if classical liberals, or perhaps you'd call them libertarians, like Hayek and Mises, didn't understand the capitalist work process or the capitalist labor market. In The Road to Serfdom, by Hayek, there is a rather chilling passage in which he writes that the manager of any plant needs to be given considerable power. And he approvingly quotes an engineer on the importance of economic spontaneity. Here's the quote from the engineer. "There ought to be surrounding the work a comparatively large area of unplanned economic action. There should be a place from which workers can be drawn. And when a worker is fired, he should vanish from the job and from the payroll. In the absence of such a free reservoir, discipline cannot be maintained without corporal punishment, as with slave labor." In other words, what Hayek and his engineer buddy are telling us is that the role of workers is to obey the discipline imposed from above. And they're saying that the great advantage of a free labor market and a free reservoir of people who will starve if they don't obey is that this discipline can be imposed on them in an impersonal way. Okay? They don't have to be beaten. You know, we don't have to beat them with our fist. We can let the invisible fist beat them. In his book, Human Action, Mises noted that people in a contractual society depend on other people, but he argued that many writers misinterpreted and distorted the state of affairs. Why? Because they concluded that the workers are at the mercy of their employers. Okay, so we're all geared up to learn from Mises how it misrepresents and distorts things to say that workers are at the mercy of their employers. So what he then writes is, now, it is true that the employer has the right to fire the employee, but... Okay, so now we're finally going to learn what the misrepresentation and the distortion are, right? He continues, but if he, the employer, makes use of this right to fire workers in order to indulge his whims, he hurts his own interests. It is to his own disadvantage if he discharges a better man in order to hire a less efficient one. The end. Mises then starts talking about shopkeepers and consumers. So what have we learned? What he's told us is that the capitalists who succeed as capitalists only get rid of workers when it is in their interest to get rid of workers. Therefore, the workers are not really at the mercy of their employers. This is just like saying that a successful totalitarian state only executes dissidents when it is in the state's interest to execute the dissidents. Therefore, the dissidents are not really at the mercy of the state. Make sense of that if you can. I can't. Now, it's true that the labor market transaction between a company and a worker is a voluntary transaction in a certain very peculiar sense of voluntary. You know, nobody's holding a gun to the worker's head in the market. And there's a concept in economics, the concept of a Pareto improvement, and it's often used to claim that any voluntary transaction between two parties is good for society. Since it's a voluntary transaction, it obviously makes both parties, the company and the worker, better off in their own estimation. And no third party is hurt, so on the basis of individualistic libertarian ethics, it seems that one can say that the voluntary transaction is unambiguously good for society. At least that's the story. Now, to his credit, Professor Beland doesn't believe this story at all. He's aware that the starting point just before the transaction matters a lot. For instance, if you have to sell your house for $5,000, almost nothing, or else starve, you're better off after you sell your house than if you were just a moment before you sold the house. But given a different starting point, a starting point where you had enough to eat without having to sell your house, you might be better off not selling the house. And this second situation is clearly better for you than the first one. And so Professor Beland has written, quote, if we take the Pareto criterion without thinking about it and apply it on an empirical situation akin to the ones we find in the developing world, then it appears rather outrageous. There's nothing natural or equal or just about the starting point, which means the Pareto criterion only cements this situation. But radical change may be more just. I think that's exactly correct. What was some hand motion?
I'm okay. With you.
The key point here is that a voluntary transaction only cements, reinforces, and perpetuates the starting point. If the starting point just before the transaction is bad, then the end point just after the transaction is almost as bad. Garbage in, garbage out. So when we look at the transaction between a company and a worker, we can't really talk about good or bad in abstraction from the starting point. So let's consider that. What is the starting point that makes the great majority of the population have to choose between either starvation or working under the domination of one or another capitalist? And is there any other possible starting point? Even more pertinent, was there, in fact, at one time, a different starting point? And was it better for working people? Okay, the starting point of capitalist-dominated production is what Marx, following Adam Smith, called previous accumulation. It's now generally called primitive accumulation of capital, but there was nothing primitive about it. It started about in the year 1500 in Britain. Now, before that point, the working people were no longer serfs. The large majority of them, you know, in Britain were free peasants. They engaged in subsistence farming. They farmed for themselves and their families. And in practice, if not exactly in the written law, the land they farmed belonged to them. And even as late as the 1690s, there were more of these free, independent peasants than there were capitalist farmers in Britain. But by about 1750, they had all disappeared. What happened to them? A large part of the answer is that the landlords decided to capitalize on the rising price of wool by driving the peasants off the land and turning the land into sheep farms. Somewhat later, peasants who had farmed land that had been owned by the Catholic Church were also evicted. And there were other events. The upshot is that people who had been free peasants, who worked for themselves, were forcibly driven from the land. But that by itself wasn't enough to turn them into employees of capitalists. What they first did generally is they became beggars or vagabonds, you know, wanderers or robbers. So then harsh laws were imposed, not only against robbery, but also against begging and wandering. And there were punishments, which included whipping, imprisonment, slavery, and the slaves who ran away or rebelled could be put to death. So forcible expropriation, taking away of property, violence, and repression by the state are what created a new starting point, the capitalist starting point, in which the great majority of the population has to choose between starvation and working under the domination of one or another capitalist.
2 minutes left.
Okay. And so given this new starting point that they did not voluntarily choose, working people began to voluntarily work under the domination of capitalists. And these voluntary labor market transactions only cement this situation, reinforce and perpetuate this new and much less free starting point. A genuinely free society requires that we undo, reverse, this expropriation, this taking away of property. We need to return to individual property in the sense that the direct producers, the people who actually do the work, have ownership and control over the land, buildings, tools, raw materials, and so forth that they need to make a living. So if you're for reestablishing individual property in this sense, reversing this forcible expropriation, you and Marx are on exactly the same side. This is exactly what he envisioned in the culminating chapter of his book, Capital. I'm going to quote, "The expropriators are expropriated. Capitalist private property is the first negation of individual private property as founded on the labor of the proprietor. But capitalist production begets, with the inexorability of a law of nature, its own negation. The negation of the negation. This does not reestablish private property for the producer, but gives him individual property. That's the goal, based on the acquisition of the capitalist era, that is, on cooperation and the possession in common of the land and of the means of production." Direct quote from Marx. Now, let me just say finally, it is conceivable that when individual property is returned to the great mass of people, some of them may want to work under the domination of others in return for a wage. I think that's bizarre, but it is just barely conceivable. Okay? So, if you are an absolutist about transactions, freedom of exchange, what I recommend is this. Support the expropriation of the expropriation of the expropriators. Then, after that's been accomplished, advocate that people who possess individual property should be allowed to work under the domination of others if they so choose. Time. But don't hold your breath.
Thank you, Professor Kleiman. Professor Beeland, you have 15 minutes for your opening statement. You may start when you wish.
All right, thank you. So, I will not argue for capitalism. The reason is not that Andrew did such a good job and convinced me. but rather that it's just such a confusing term. To the leftists, it's about privilege, usually sanctioned by the government or the state. To those on the right, it's usually to be pro-business, using taxpayers' money to prop up businesses. So I stay away from that term, and I think it was even coined by Marx. Instead, I will talk about the free market, because I think that is what society is about if we are truly free. There, I see no difference between the market and society. Those are two sides of the same coin. So when I talk about the free market, don't think of me as Donald Trump or some other Republican. That's not what I mean by a free market. That would be the pro-business type of market. I'm not that kind. I'm talking about complete freedom, complete voluntarist society, where we choose ourselves because if we want to exchange with some other, we do it because we're better off doing so. There are no arbitrary limitations to our actions. That's a very, very brief summary or explanation for what the free market means. There are no regulations. It's purely voluntary. Now, in this country, since we're in Sweden talking, Republicans and others who probably talk about this as a mixed economy. Of course, that's a little ridiculous from my perspective. Mixed, sure, but in a country where 50% of what we're producing is expropriated by the state in an already regulated market, I wouldn't call that a mix between free market and state. I would call that state. That's basically it. Okay, so keep that in mind. When I talk about free market, I talk about free people, free individuals, and nothing else. And I'm starting from the beginning, Professor Kleiman's argumentation about wage slavery basically starts halfway. I will start with just property. Now, the case for libertarianism is really a moral one. It's a case that is based on a principle about non-aggression. A principle which states simply that I have no right to impose physical violence on Professor Kleiman, whether I like it or not, and I also have no right to threaten such force. That is libertarianism in a nutshell. That is the free market in a nutshell. I'm free and can contract with whomever I like, whenever I like, basically on whatever terms I like as well. This means that libertarianism is a minimalist ideology. It's an ideology that you can fill with whatever practice you want and whatever practice you like. It's a live and let live type of ideology. In a libertarian society, you can have your Marxist commune. That's no big deal. The question is, in a Marxist society, can you have your libertarian commune? If the answer is no, well, then I can stop right there because I win on knockout. So what this really means, if we're truly free and individuals, that means that there is no blueprint. We cannot say that this society this is what society should be like. Society should be structured exactly this way. We cannot show an architecture or a structure for what society must be like in order to be just. Because I don't have that power. You don't have that power. Sophia doesn't have that power. Professor Kleiman, and that's a good thing, doesn't have that power, right? So if none of us have that power, we can't really say exactly what's going to be. It's really an ideology that talks about the means and not the end. The means are whatever we choose the means are. The means are all voluntary. The end is whatever emerges when we voluntarily interact or choose not to interact. That is what libertarianism means. Now, this means that society is really an open-ended enterprise. It is something that fluctuates, that changes all the time, and we can't really say at any point whether we're in the right place or the wrong place. What we can do is simply act in whatever way we find moral or ethical. But it means we cannot guarantee anything. We cannot guarantee schooling for everybody or education for everybody. We cannot guarantee that no one ever is poor. But we can also say that no one is ever forced, because that's the principle we live by, and that's the principle that we will enforce voluntarily, of course. Now, libertarianism is an ideology where we have no illusions about man. It's not an ideology where we have this utopia, and whenever we get there, people will change. They will behave differently. We'll see the rise of a new socialist man, some people claim. on the socialist side, that is. We claim nothing of this, that kind, because we treat people just like they are. And we recognize that people are different. Some are egotistical, narcissistic assholes. They are going to exist in a utopia as well. The question is, what does society do with those people, and how do they affect our lives? Because obviously, since we're in here, we're not those people, right? But we don't like them. So how can we deal with those people? Well, the answer is market. And the reason the answer is market is voluntary exchange. You can be so much better off if you produce for others rather than just for yourself, which means that we focus our efforts. It means that we need to trade, we need to exchange with others in order to actually live up to that potential. Now, in exchange, both parties are better off, just like Professor Kleinman mentioned. Now, if the starting point is an oppressive one, it still doesn't change the fact that in exchange, you're both better off, because otherwise you wouldn't choose to go through with it. If the starting point is horrendous, well, you're still better off doing it, or you wouldn't choose to do it. It's that easy. You always have a choice not to do it. The question then, of course, is what is a just starting point? And I totally agree with Professor Kleinman there that it should be a just starting point. Now, what happens if we exchange and we're both better off? If Professor Kleinman has something I want more than when he wants it, and I have something that Professor Kleinman wants, and he wants it more than I want it, well, then we just exchange stuff, and of course, we're both better off doing so. Or another way of thinking about this is, if I'm a baker and I have a hammer, and Professor Kleinman is a builder and he has flour, we would be better off exchanging those things so that the builder has the hammer and the baker has the flour. Of course, this also means that the output increases. This also means that the rest of society is better off, if, of course, the starting point is a just one. Now, this is important because in a free society, we exchange and we produce value. We produce to satisfy others. This is how we keep the narcissistic, egotistical assholes in check, right? Because if we produce and focus our production on something we know that others want, it is in my interest to serve others. And that is how a totally free market works. I produce not to satisfy my own needs, but indirectly I do, because I produce what I know what all of you need, and I sell it to you so that I get the means to satisfy my own ends. Now, this means you create value through production, but it also means that the value is realized through consumption. It is through consuming a certain thing that we satisfy a need. It is through consuming something, whether it's a service or a good or whatever it is, it is through consuming this that we are better off. This is also why we exchange. Now, I write about this in The Seen, the Unseen, and the Unrealized in terms of Smith, Ricardo, and Schumpeter. And the reason I combine all of those people is that Adam Smith is known for talking about the invisible hand or fist, depending on who you ask. And fist, according to two of you in here. The invisible hand, but he's also talking about the division of labor, something that Marx started with, and most economists in the 19th century started with, simply because specializing means that you're so much more productive. Now, Adam Smith talked about the pin factory, in which different workers do different things, and there are like 19 operations or something like that necessary in order to produce a pin. And he shows in this example that by splitting those tasks between us, all 19 of us, we can produce something like between 2,300 and 4,600% more pins. Now, since we produce a lot more pins, this means we can satisfy a lot more wants for pins. Obviously, we're all better off if we specialize, but it's also the case, as Ricardo talked about, that we're not exactly the same. Adam Smith talked about how he used very manual, not very advanced labor at all, and still he got these outcomes. David Ricardo talks about, since we're different, we should do what we're relatively speaking best at, which means we will always increase the output, the outcome, the consumption, this satisfaction of needs if we do what we're relatively better at. Combine those two and people are in the right place within specialization and the division of labor. Add to that Schumpeter and you have innovation as well. Then you have the production of new capital that can make labor more productive. This is what capital is. It's really tools, machines that help laborers produce even more output. And that's where we want to be because then we can satisfy a lot more wants. And this is how we satisfy consumption needs and how we create value. Now, where does this lead us? Well, it necessarily leads us to entrepreneurship, which is my field of study. Now, in entrepreneurship, imagine this open-ended enterprise that is society. What is entrepreneurship? Well, it is production. Well, production of what? It is very easy if we here adopt a model of society where everything is fixed, nothing changes much, we know exactly what resources there are, so we can just reallocate them. Well, that's not true. Because in an open society, nothing is instantaneous. Production certainly isn't. A new car model takes about 10 years to develop. So any type of production is very uncertain, simply because we aim for needs that have not really been realized just yet. So people's preferences are volatile. People's needs are personal and subjective. They're even contextual. Steve Jobs mentioned once that sometimes consumers don't know what they want until they see it. Well, this is a task of the entrepreneur to produce these things that consumers will want, to satisfy the needs that will emerge. In such a society, it's very, very difficult to redistribute wealth, to redistribute the means of production, because you don't know to what end. The only way of doing this is through decentralized decision-making through entrepreneurship, because that is how you aggregate all the people's wishes and all the people's imaginations of what might be. That's the only way we can combine the local knowledge of everybody and all their guesses and figure out how to best use the resources and create new ones. We should not forget that. We create new resources all the time. It's not a matter of some people accumulating capital and then everybody else is left without. It's a matter of how we create more capital. That is the true question here. Do we create more or not? And in a market, we do create more, a lot more, and very quickly as well.
2 minutes left.
All right. Now, the non-aggression principle of libertarianism is compatible with many different views of what property is. I myself am a soft propertarian, which means I'm not a neo-Lockean in any sense of the word. Instead, I think that just property is acquired through use of that which is unused. And it's a use claim that happens where there is no challenge or objection to that claim. Now, whether this is important or not sort of depends on Professor Kleiman's comments on what I'm saying right now. But we should realize that property in some form or another is necessary in an open enterprise society as the free market. It is necessary in a society where capital overall is expanding, where we are increasing our prosperity as time goes by and as we work and engage in work. And in this society, also we should recognize that loss is probably more important than profit. Profit is the big motivator, the driving force of the market, yes, but loss is what moderates it. Loss is what tempers it. Loss is what keeps those very narcissistic, very focused, and sort of hotheads out of business. Without loss, we would see no focus of capital in the hands of those who are most able, which is necessarily a problem. With loss, we would have people lose capital if they're doing a bad job rather immediately, whereas the capital will be redirected through market prices to those who do a lot better job. Now, the market is not efficient. It is a messy, an approximate enterprise, but the reason for that is that it's an open-ended enterprise. Society does not have a goal. It doesn't have an end, so we can't really say, but the market is unbeatable because it includes everybody, and everybody has their say. A no buy is as important as loss. Time. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Professor Bjuland. Each speaker will now be given 10 minutes for responses. Professor Kleiman, you may start when you wish.
Okay. So just sit back for a minute, and then I'll start.
Yeah, sure. Why not?
The one question that I think I can respond to, is can you have your libertarian commune in a Marxist society? I mean, I would never call a society a Marxist society. It's not a society that runs according to the vision of some dead guy, you know? That's a misnomer. But let's talk about, you know, a communal society, you know, with individual property, but not private property, where people freely associate, okay, socialism. Can you have a libertarian commune in that society? No. But, wait a minute. You can establish your own society. What that would, if you want to be a libertarian in that society, it means you don't want to be part of society. And we know a lot of libertarians say there is no such thing as society. They're only individuals. So you can go and be individuals. You start your own society. As long as you respect non-aggression, there's no problem. You do your thing. We do our thing. What's the problem? Okay? And if you remember, I even concluded by saying you want to advocate, you know, in a system where people do have individual property, that they relinquish that And sell themselves to some the highest bidder or whatever. You want to advocate for that, that's fine, okay? But if you want to have a different society, you go establish a different society. You go pick berries, you know, raspberries. The other one picks strawberries, and then you can exchange raspberries for strawberries. Fine with me. You're probably all going to starve because you don't have any means of production, you know? And the one thing that I would never allow is that, you know, you go take our means of production and, you know, make us poor, you know, to then have the society. But, I mean, I think this is actually completely, what I'm saying, I think is completely consonant with the ethics of libertarianism as I understand it. You do your thing, we do our thing. Okay, you don't want to be part of our society? You're not part of our society. You go establish your own society. I don't see the problem there. And, you know, free speech within our society, yeah, I don't see any problem with that either. I'm all for that. I mean, I think free speech is really important. I do think that social change leads to changes in the way people think and behave and so forth, but I'm not making anything, you know, I think we can have socialism right now with people the way they are. You know, some are assholes, some are, you know, dicks, some are okay, some are good. I mean, yeah, okay. So I don't think it's the case that we have to totally transform the nature of human beings, you know, before we can have a just society. I think what we need to do is, as I said, return to a situation in which the great mass of people have individual property, you know, and don't have to basically turn themselves into a kind of slave, a wage slave, you know, year after year after year, generation after generation after generation. Okay. Now, as I understand it, what Professor Bjuland and I said about exchange, voluntary transactions, is exactly the same, only he made it sound good. but I don't think we have any disagreement, okay? Yeah, you were a little bit better off after the exchange than you were before, you know. So you have to sell your house for $5,000 so that you don't starve. Okay, so now you have the $5,000 and you don't starve, but you're homeless. You did it, so obviously you benefit from that. I mean, you know, that's the nature in which voluntary exchange, you know, always has to be good. However, you still can't say that voluntary exchange between two individuals is always good for society as a whole. If you're trying to do, you know, a social ethics here, you can't say it because there are third parties. These third parties may be hurt by your voluntary transaction. In their own subjective estimation, if we believe in subjective preferences, a lot of people do not like exchange societies. That means that a lot of us are hurt by your market transactions. How do I know this? I look at the news, you look at the anti-globalization movement, you look at the protests against trade deals and so forth. There are a lot of people who don't like this. So if you want to respect, you know, the subjective preferences and their expression in these kinds of actions, then you're dealing with a situation in which you're actually advocating some people be better off and some people be worse off. Okay? I don't see anything else that I could respond to here. It was a bit abstract, and I don't mean that as a derogatory comment, but because it was kind of like at a high level of abstraction, I don't relate to these kinds of questions that way, so it's about all I can say.
Thank you, Professor Kleiman. Professor Bieland.
Oh, I get to respond too?
Cool.
Yeah. So the big difference, I think, between Professor Kleiman and myself is that he believes in power, I do not. And what I mean by that is that he talks all the time about how we should have individual property and basically redistribution. Now, what happens if I accumulate capital? What happens if I'm very successful at satisfying everybody else's needs? What happens if I then become a little richer than someone else? Does that mean that Professor Kleiman walks in with a big sword and says, "You there, hand out your property"? Or where does this end? This is the difference, I think, between us, because you start somewhere either at midpoint or at the end, and then you want to fix things. It goes back to the blueprintism that I talked about before. Whereas I start from the beginning and say, okay, so if we have just acquisition of property, then we will have a prosperous society, very likely. And it will be just if all the transactions are just. That's a big difference between us. Another difference is Professor Kleiman starts with means of production. Where the hell did they come from? I talked about innovation. I talked about figuring out how to satisfy needs, creating machines, creating new tools that we're not certain will actually be all that helpful and productive in the future. Professor Kleiman talks about, let's redistribute the tools we have. Well, where did they come from? If we start from the beginning, someone has to produce those tools. Someone has to figure out what tools are needed. Someone needs to figure out if those resources are used in a good way or a very wasteful way. Now, how do we know that? Well, this challenge was posed 96 years ago, as you know, by Mises, saying that there's no way you can calculate this without an actual market in the means of production. But how can you have a market if you redistribute the means of production? How can everybody has a right to their individual property, their own means of production that they need in order to survive, if I understand this correctly. Well, why would you then innovate? Where would that come from? See, this is a chicken and egg problem. We start with resources. We start with means of production, machines. Maybe we have a Boeing 747 and all these things. Well, then we can redistribute those, sure. Where the heck did it come from? It didn't just spontaneously emerge from nothing. It was a result of lots of different transactions. So we need to ask those hard questions. Where do these things come from? And I'm not saying, of course, that exactly what is produced today is a good thing. Absolutely not. I mean, the trade deals that Professor Kleiban mentioned, I'm opposed to those as well, because those are managed trade. Those are not free trade. So we need to talk about what things are like in the beginning. What is society actually like originally? Now, let's see. What else did you talk about? Well, another issue where you started halfway was talking about the economic laws of capitalism. Well, there are no economic laws of capitalism that don't apply elsewhere. There are laws of economics. The laws of economics always apply, as you know, a colleague in economics. You're free to work for another master. Well, that also starts halfway. Well, because then you already have enterprise and big businesses which are there because of the government, because of the state. They're propped up by government. They have privilege, which is why they are big, which is why they make a lot of money, which is also why the workers don't really have a choice but accept employment. Well, if you're opposed to the state as I am, and you don't want that to begin with, well, then that's not really a critique against my position. It just misses the target. So let's see here. What else is there? Well, I'll make it easy for you, and I'll stop there. How about that?
Thank you, Professor Bieland. We will now take a short 10-minute break. If you wish to visit the book tables, please do so. Or a quick trip through the bar. It's up to you. It's your own freedom to do as you wish with these 10 minutes. But then we will have to return for our questions and answers section. Thank you very much.
The microphone is on a stand right over here, just by the stage. So if we have any people interested in asking questions, please line up to do so. It would be really nice if you did. Anyway, I'm going to be the capitalist of this situation. And obviously, I'm going to be a moderator as well. Anyway, let me go through some specifics regarding how we're going to do this thing. You guys will have 1 minute to pose your questions, and please state to whom your question is directed, to Mr. Kleiman or Mr. Bieland or both. They will then be given 1 minute each, or if the question is directed to one of them, they will receive 2 minutes to respond, unless I decide that they need more time, since I'm now a dictator slash capitalist slash moderator. Anyway, on that note, I will take the first question myself. So my question is to Mr. Kleiman. I have a kind of an off-topic question, but in your understanding of Marx's ideas on how to reach the utopia or the socialist idea, does it not follow that capitalism needs to reach its final stage, so to speak? And do you think it has?
I don't think Marx was such a determinist. I think that we've reached a very high stage. There's been a lot of progress in some respects, a lot of regress. We're very technologically advanced. The objective conditions for a much better society are available. For instance, in Marx's day, you know, it may have been the case that prices provided information that you couldn't get any other way. You know, for an efficient society, now we have computers, now we have apps, we're good to go.
Okay, thank you for that. So, first question.
I think, yes, I would also like to ask a question on the panel.
I'm sorry, the second question.
As a proletarian, I yep. revolt.
Please take the stage.
So my question is directed to Professor Beeland. I didn't hear you disagreeing with Andrew's recitation of Marx's description on how property was unjustly distributed. So, and you said yourself, you like to start from the beginning. How do we create new initial conditions? Well, we live in a concrete society now. Don't you agree this society has to be transformed into something else? Otherwise, you're just, you know, playing simulation games in your mind.
Playing games is fun. yes, I think you're right. Libertarianism starts with just property. And I don't mean only property, I mean justly acquired property. And, of course, some are interested in going through a land reform or something like that. And I think that the property relations today are unjust, and they are derived from feudal times. So they're based off of oppression. They're based off of expropriation, much of it by the state. I think the only way of being practical and solving this problem is not to provide power to one or two individuals to distribute property equally to individuals, because individuals probably have unequal claims, just claims. Rather, it would be to start anew without a state and let the market take care of it, because I don't think that if you don't use your property, you will lose your property in the market. The property is what you earn by serving others. So it will be taken care of very quickly, I think, in the market.
Okay, so first question from the audience.
Do I get one question or get a minute of questions?
Sorry? No.
Do I get one question or a minute of questions?
Just one, please.
All right. We've been talking a lot about like owning things and how property has been redistributed historically and currently. And you're talking about we have to give back private ownership to the individual. I mean, in our current society, we're not even actually allowed to things. We might own land, we might own property, but at the end of the day, if the state wants it, the state takes it. Like, we don't really own anything, at least not here in Sweden. So my question is, this is actually for both of you guys. It's been discussed a bit with this. Like, how do you take back property from people when someone else already owns it? I mean, in your opinion, Andrew, I might be misunderstanding you, but from what I'm hearing, it sounds like you want people to, or say workers, for example, to be able to take the factory that they work in or whatever their means of production is. And how do we do that without using force against someone else? And how is that moral and how is it not moral?
Okay. I mean, I hope this can be accomplished without force. It can be accomplished very simply. The expropriators undo their injustice against the rest of us by simply walking away. And then they can go establish their society and pick berries and just leave us alone. Okay? So that's the simple way to do it without force. This society, as you have to understand, this society is built at every moment and in every institution, every nook and cranny on force. Okay? So, you know, I mean, if you are attacked, is it right to use force? People might disagree. But we are under attack at every moment. Okay? There is a state propping up the existing property relations. That is force already.
Yeah, all right. So if I understood it correctly...
Sorry, just one question.
Yeah, but I just want that I understood what he's actually saying, is that if it comes down to it, you're saying that other people should move simply because they have a different point of view than you. I mean, what gives you the right to tell them to get the fuck out and start picking berries in the woods and not you?
Thank you.
I counted three questions there, but thank you.
Okay. I understood your question was directed to both of them, but should I recant that, or...? Okay. You have 1 minute if you want.
Okay, I think I partly responded to this as my answer to Emmanuel's question. And I agree with Professor Kleiman that any property relation today is based off on force, but it's also based on labor. It's also based on just claims, even though the basis might not be fully just, which makes it a really, really difficult problem to solve because you cannot trace all the way back to original acquisition of property. That's impossible. You have to start anew somehow. And I think the best way of doing that is to figure out who serves humankind best. That is the market, by producing to satisfy other people's needs. So I think within probably 10 or 20 years in a completely free market, you would have the resources in the hands of those who are best at serving That's others.
Good. Okay. Next question.
Okay. So it's basically a question to Professor Bylan again around surrounding education. So if it's not true that there is a correlation between not reassuring every child's right to education and, for example, child labor, and also if you do not have the equality of opportunity, do you truly have a free market between individuals or do you have a monopolistic one?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, the first part
You went from education...
Well, if you don't, if every individual does not have the same opportunity in life, then is it not true? Is it truly then a free market, or is it if you look at a free market between between individuals, if certain individual has a great well?
Okay, so it's the Rawlsian question basically. What is an opportunity? Is that measured by the outcome of your actions, or is it measured by something else at the origin? And how do you explain that some people are able to create a lot out of almost nothing and some people create nothing out of almost everything? I mean, what is an opportunity? That's the question back to you, because it's very difficult to say that, well, we should have equal opportunity. That's a simple statement. What is that in practice? It means absolutely nothing. Does it mean we all should have $1,000 when we are born? Or does it mean we should all have caring parents? And how do you enforce that without oppressing others? I see it as a non-issue.
Next question.
So to any of the professors that feel they might want to answer, both of you, I think, spoke about the non-aggression principle. So are you both secretly anarchists just playing devil's advocate with each other? Or? Basically, the fact that you kind of agreed that we can both have the two coexisting societies and they shouldn't be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I'm against the state. Marx was against the state. What we recognize, however, is that to return to the pre-existing society where there was individual property, the expropriators have to be expropriated, okay? And that will require the rule of the majority over the minority, which is a state.
Okay, I think I have my answer.
Pai, do you want to answer?
I don't know. I mean, I am an anarchist, so that's easy to answer. I do not think that the right way or the way towards liberty and freedom and equality is to increase inequality and unfreedom, that is going through the state and enforcing something else. And like I mentioned to the previous question there, that opportunity is a subjective thing, and we don't even know whether to assess an opportunity beforehand or after the fact. So how can we even talk about what is an opportunity? It's what people make of it, which makes Professor Kleinman's position impossible.
Okay. Go ahead.
My question is primarily for Professor Kleinman. I heard a lot of bashing of capitalism, but I'm not sure I really understood what your alternative would look like. Is there a state? And in that case, what's the role of the state? And what happens as soon as someone acquires more resources than someone else? Do people come knocking at your door to redistribute them? Or what does it look like exactly?
Okay, well, I just said I'm not in favor of the state, but if we're going to have a return to the individual property for the great mass of people, There's got to be, you know, the expropriation of the expropriators. I mean, that just has to be the case. Excuse me?
You can please be quiet.
Yeah. It means that we return to the previous situation. Who are you not to favor giving the immense majority of people back what belonged to them? Okay. Now, I don't think that people can retain individual property if resources are divided up. So I think that we're going to have to work out ways to share them. Because most of them are social, except in terms of the titles to property right now. You know, like the shipbuilding industry is not. How do you divide up shipbuilding, right? You know, if you don't have private property but individual property.
Okay, next question.
Start with a couple of random comments here, but like giving. Re-equalizing and giving back property ostensibly to the previous owners. That was tried in Zimbabwe with disastrous results, no matter how tenuous the claim may have been. But anyways, the point here is, isn't this a rear whole thing, a rear guard battle? I mean, Marxism, sharing resources, etc., or for that matter, opposing it, I mean, here we have in this small country alone, millions of people with sizable pension funds. We have large companies, especially in the United States, like Microsoft, Apple, Google, whatever, where the capital is between the ears of the various employees, and they go home every day, and they're the capitalists.
Do you have a question, Nils?
Yeah, well, comment on that latter. Well, isn't this sort of becoming irrelevant, slowly but steadily, the whole business of capital? I mean, this time...
Who are you asking?
Well, primarily Dr...
Feynman,
thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Nils.
If Per wants to say something, that's fine.
Is capital becoming irrelevant? I don't think so, if that's the question. I didn't hear a real reason why that I could actually understand. If there's time that could be elaborated, I'd be happy to try to answer.
Okay.
Could I say something to you?
Sure.
To this? I think there's this great myth within Marxism, and I think I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think that Professor Kleinman is upholding that myth, and that is that if you have capital, it will sort of mythically grow and become bigger, whereas if you don't have capital, you will get smaller and smaller, comparatively speaking. And Piketty had that same argument, and I think it's a fundamentally flawed argument, because the only way you can actually grow your capital is to serve others and to produce for consumers what consumers actually want. And that's the only way you can get things back. If you don't do that, you're actually falling behind and losing because you own capital that is not productive enough. So I think there's this great myth that just because I own a machine, I'm going to be filthily rich and even richer and richer every day that passes by.
Okay.
First of all, thank you very much. So a question to Professor Kleinman. So let's say given an expropriation of the expropriators and return to individual property, as I understand it, you meant that after that we could have voluntary exchanges between two parties. But you also said there could be third parties that are affected by these, mm-hmm. According to their subjective feelings. So what do you mean by that? Do you mean that if some third party is like jealous of them, shouldn't they be able to do it? On what ethical ground are you basing this? How much is affecting a third party? Because I know Per would say that it's you cannot apply force to the third party, and then it's fine if it's voluntary between the two parties. But the third party, if it's just his subjective feelings, on what ground are you basing that, and what are the criterions for this?
Okay, third parties are often affected, I think, like regularly affected. I was not advocating in a new, you know, communal socialist society, voluntary exchange whereby you give up your rights to property and you alienate them to somebody else and you go work for them. That, no, I'm not in favor of that. I'm in favor of people who believe in that being allowed to advocate that, and I urge them first to get behind the project of expropriating the expropriators to return us to a more just starting point, and then begin to advocate that. Maybe people will want to listen more.
Yeah, but given that we have done that, and
given that we've done that, then
are
what?
Are we allowed to trade voluntarily between two people without a third party interfering?
You know, I'm a person. I got my views. That's all. I'm not the society. The society will decide. You advocate for what you want, okay? I don't think that when most people have property once again, they're going to want to, like, okay, yeah, let's voluntarily have capitalism and give up our property and so we can become wage workers for other people. They might want to do it, but don't hold your breath, like I said. But you can, you know, I think you should be free to advocate that. What I don't think people should be, you know, doing is remaining silent about the totally unjust, inhuman, unfree start of the society and the continuation on the basis of that.
Okay, next question.
First of all, thank you all for an interesting discussion so far. My question is for Professor Bieland. Professor, in your opening remarks, you spoke of libertarianism descriptively, as I understood it, as a set of principles characterized by non-aggression, kind of tolerance, inclusion, really certainly pluralism. I'm just trying to square that. A colleague of yours at the Mises Institute in Sweden, Klaus Bernpaintner, has written in positive terms about the so-called alt-right movement. The alt-right movement, of course, a grassroots movement best known for its enthusiastic embrace of Donald Trump, not exactly an anarchist, not exactly a pluralistic or tolerant, rather an authoritarian politician, also known for their vicious, anti-Semitic, aggressive, violent rhetoric, and for constituting a new generation of Western white nationalists. So my question to you is, do you agree with your colleague that libertarianism has something to learn from the alt-right? Are these two movements in any way aligned? And if so, how close? Thank you.
Well, I can't speak for Klaus, and I haven't seen that particular piece. I can't really comment on it. In general, I would say, yeah, we can learn from everybody. Maybe something from the alt-right movement. I don't know. I don't know enough about them. Do we have a lot in common with them? I don't think libertarianism has all that much in common with any other movement, because they're the opposite, or the non-libertarians are primarily statists, and they want to rely on force in enforcing the society of their dreams, whatever it may be. It's usually their individual preference, and they want to hit everybody over the head until they just conform to their views. And in that sense, no, we can probably ally with any movement on a single issue. I don't think we have any brethren in the alt-right movement or the left movement or any other statist movement. No.
Okay, thank you.
I'm not really that interested in property, except insofar as it affects the kind of work that people have to do. I'm interested in the labor that people have to carry out and therefore how we live our lives. And only in that sense does Andrew's stuff about individual property have any meaning for me, because that's the precondition for it. One of the things that Per said that was interesting was he was talking about different people producing different things, and that being what allows society as a whole to become richer, because the baker has a hammer which he exchanges with the builder who has flour. The problem is that in a society based upon individual exchange, it is the quantities and the proportions in which the flour exchanges with the hammer that determines how our labour time is distributed and how our lives consequently are organised. What do you think of that? as a problem that needs to be overcome, because I think that's inbuilt into the way that capitalism functions as a society.
I don't think the quantities of the goods that are exchanged actually decide the prices of them, but how they contribute to satisfying people's wants and needs. So what you're talking about is the supply side, but there's also a demand side. If you have both, you get the price. So I don't think you can say that if there's a lot of flour and there's just one hammer, then the hammer is worth a lot. It depends on what you can do with the hammer and how people value what you do with the hammer, as well as the flour. And between those two, you get prices and you can sort of compare them. But it's not only supply side, no.
Go ahead.
Thank you. I have a question for both of the professors. And suppose that we have your two utopias. We have expropriated the expropriators, and we are all abolishing wage slavery, and we have our individual property in the one hand. And on the other hand, we have this little Galtian Gulch where people are greedy bastard Gordon Geckos in I think it was Bieland, scenario. Well, if we have these two scenarios where obviously the state has withered away or been abolished in some kind of other, basically, who will build the roads? We have we have this enormous large-scale projects, decades in the making, involving thousands of individuals.
Sounds like a threat.
And they need to live during the time of building this. How will this be done in your different scenarios? How could this be? I want to get home tonight. So.
Thank you. Andrew, you want to start?
Yeah. What I'm talking about is not a utopia. It actually existed in England prior to the primitive accumulation of capital, the forcible expropriation of the yeoman peasantry. Okay. Now, they didn't have large-scale road projects, but you don't need a state to have a large-scale road project. You just need a community.
Okay. Ken?
You just need a community and you stay there. I don't really see a problem because entrepreneurs and private interests, they build a lot more expensive and vast things than roads every day. What screws them up is the state. So the reason we have inefficient and bad roads, which you can think about when you travel home tonight, is the state. We would have better roads, maybe flying cars, if we didn't have the state.
Yes, so I have a question for Professor Kleiman. You talked a lot about starting points in your initial statements. Mm-hmm. So I'm a worker. I don't own my means of production. That's my starting point. Mm-hmm. And I want to live in the libertarian society. Mm-hmm. And to that, Professor Kleiman says, it's fine if we go away. Woods and berries are mentioned, and I don't imagine that we get to keep even our justly acquired property, maybe not even our clothes. Wouldn't your policy be to worsen my starting point beyond what was already established by yourself as unfair, simply for the way I want to live my life as a free human being? Isn't that the case, and how is that compatible with freedom?
The great mass of people were expropriated. Okay,
well, including me or my ancestors.
Oh no! The reason you're a wage worker, okay, and all you have is the clothes on your back or whatever. The reason is that the great mass of people were expropriated, and then the system just grew and grew and grew and took over more and more. Okay, so I mean, you'd be doing better under you know a communal society. Look, it's very simple. You want to belong to something, you belong. You don't want to belong to something, you don't belong to it. What?
This is not even remotely answering the question. You're just keeping on talking about starting points. Because I was expropriated. I don't belong to the expropriators. I already established that I belong to the working class. Right?
Who's going to take anything away from you?
You.
No, I'm not.
Well, no. you want to expropriate and create this new starting point where it's fine for me to go basically naked.
Wait, what do you own right now that I would be expropriating?
Well, my home, maybe, I don't know.
No, keep your home.
So I can keep my home and keep on living here, so I don't have
to go into... Yeah, absolutely.
A libertarian society is...
As long as you're part of the community, why would we want to kick you out?
The libertarian society is possible within the socialist society.
I'm sorry.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Let's wrap that up.
Okay, so less tension for my question. It's a more contemporary issue, the one on the rising inequality in terms of wealth and income. I think this has been more or less established by thinkers like Piketty, as you mentioned earlier, and more contemporary media recently, more moderate media. So, and this might have consequences, democratic consequences. So for both of you, how has this happened and is it a problem?
Okay. I mean, inequality is built into capitalist society and it continues and so forth. I've been extremely critical of Piketty's data. It's not his personal problem exactly, but those data greatly exaggerate the increase in income inequality over the past several decades. Basically, the data set gives you different numbers every time the tax laws change because they're tax data. So every change in the tax laws affects the numbers.
Okay, this question is for Dr. Kleiman. What gives you the right to take the means of production in the first place? What if the means of production have been produced after, let's say, the 15th century? Let's say a farmer that owns the land produces a factory, per se, and hires someone to work in it. What gives you the right to take that factory? At what if I were to create a factory, uh-huh. I asked this question on an internet forum. I was allowed to have it, according to a Marxist, and own the factory as long as I didn't hire someone to work in it. But what gives you the right to take it away from me if someone starts working in it?
How would you return individual property to the people who actually work and thereby reverse the expropriation of their property?
Well, where will we begin in the first place? How will you, if you're going to take the means, let's say take the means of production, but I don't really understand how can you do that? What gives you the right to do so? The farmers before didn't own that means of production in the first place.
Yeah, they own the means of production. They belong to them. People had their own farms and worked. Okay, that was taken away from them. And the whole society and all the just acquisition, you know, of capital, so to speak, was built on that. Okay? So the point is to provide property to the vast majority of people once again so that they can live and work without having to sell themselves, you know, and their whole lifetime and their kids and so forth to capital. Okay, if you can think of another way to make that happen without giving them back the property, I'm happy to listen.
Okay, I don't know how the people who lived in the 1500s, I think they're dead, so giving it back to them wouldn't really help much.
Okay, I think we have time for one last question.
Yep. Hello, my name is Huang. I'm just a little proletarian. I was thinking, I've heard there was a definition of the concept of freedom, and I think you said, that human beings need to be freed from nature. I think it was something like that.
No, I mean, you can't be free of nature. What I've said is you get dominated by nature if you don't understand it.
But then what I'm thinking is that dominated by nature, isn't human beings a part of nature? How can you be dominated by yourself?
If you think that, you know, when you hear thunder, that it's the gods and you're afraid for your life, that's domination by nature.
So people
Thank
should
you,
be freed from
Thank
their
you.
Own minds.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so do you want to...
Oh, 7.5. This is the 7.5-minute gig?
Yes.
Yeah.
But before we begin with that, most things today start with, here's a word from our sponsors. And as you're all aware, the two sponsors this evening are MHI, Marxist Humanist Initiative, and Corax, or Bubbla, as it's called in Swedish. And if you liked this debate, and what Marxist Humanist Initiative are doing, we urge you to donate. You can do so tonight by Swish to 0735-039291. That's 0735-039291. That's to my cell phone, and mark the transaction MHI donation, so we know from whom it came, and it will go directly to Marxist Humanist Initiative. If you're not here tonight and you're watching this on YouTube or listening to this on audio, please go to the website MarxistHumanistInitiative.org. There's a big donate button there. We will thank you for all and any support that you give us. Sophia, we'll...
Yeah. So if you are currently living in Sweden, you can surf onto bubb.la and become a premium member, or premium human being, as we call it. and if you're watching online or if you're listening to audio, you can go to cor.ax, that's Corax. We are also accepting premium human beings at Corax, but we don't currently really have that many international friends yet, so please do so. Anyway, so moving on to closing statements.
Each candidate will, just to repeat the procedures, each candidate will receive 7.5 minutes for closing statements. Since Andrew began, Professor Kleiman began with his opening remarks, Professor Bieland may start with the closing statements.
Okay, so we heard Professor Kleiman talk about how we should give back to the great majority what belongs to them. And I think he mentioned the 1500s or the 15th century or something like that in England. I jokingly said that, well, they're dead. But I suppose that we would follow inheritance or something like that to figure out who actually owned, would have the just claims to that property, which is a little strange to me because anyone along that line or that delineage would be able to contract with others and they would have been able to give up property if they wanted to. So I don't see how that would be any more just. But even worse, the great majority. Who is the great majority? And we talked about the mass of people. We talked about the expropriated. Well, the thing is, I think we all end up in both the category, the expropriated and the expropriators. And the reason is the state. We do accept a little bit of the extorted money from other taxpayers. We use state services, yet we are at the same time extorted and pay our taxes or go to jail. Well, I guess free room and board is a good thing. So we always end up on both sides, which means it's not very easy to figure out who is what. Or do we just take, well, you're 51% expropriated, I'm 51% expropriator, so I'll give you all of what I have or 1%, or what do I give you? It's not that easy to figure that out. And I think that the biggest problem, really, for the Kleinmanian argument is where the means of production come from. Because in every argument we've heard, well, they should give back to them their individual property. We should redistribute the means of production that we have today. Well, the means of production, except for labor and land, are all created. If we would have not allowed a market, or if we would not allow a market from the beginning, we wouldn't have all that much means of production. It would be a pretty poor society. Maybe we would be equally poor, but we would be a poor society. If we instead allow people to voluntarily exchange and follow their dreams and do what they imagine they can do, in that case, we create a lot more. And this is the open-ended enterprise that we see as libertarians in society. This is a society that grows, that expands, that gets bigger and better and more prosperous for everyone if it's just, if there is no state. It is not a zero-sum game. It's a positive-sum game. And it's actually more than just a little bit positive. It increases a lot. We can create a huge amount of wealth, and we would be probably in the year 3500 today if it weren't for the state and the sort of wet blanket that it has put on society. If we could just start over and trade like friendly, peaceful people and trust in ourselves, in our communities, in our neighbors, and trust in others when we trade the fruits of our labor voluntarily. I'll stop there.
I think this evening's discussion has demonstrated how badly capitalism sucks. It sucks so bad that even its defenders here and in the audience won't defend it. Okay? Oh, you know, you want to take people gunpoint and shove them out of your society because they don't want to be part of your society. Gee, you don't want to be part of the society. That's your choice. Nobody's forcing you. You want to be part of it? You're part of it. You don't want to be part of it? You're not part of it. This is like libertarians like trying to create some totalitarian vision, you know, like trying to turn libertarianism into totalitarianism. You want to be part of a community? You're part of it. You don't want to be part of a community? You're not part of it. What the hell is the problem? Okay. Now, what we have been hearing is a lot of dancing around the question of where capitalism gets its start and what the whole system is based on. Okay? It is not the case that what we have is messed up property just because of feudal times and the state. There is violence built into the system, okay, for reasons that the state was involved, but also private interests were involved in a big way, landowners throwing people off the land. Okay? These were not feudal lords. Okay, we've heard no condemnation from people who call themselves libertarians of this. We've heard nothing from them about how to redress this situation. What we've heard is, oh, well, people born in the 1500s were dead and there's all kinds of problems. And let's just forget about that and accept the status quo, the starting point right now, and given the starting point in which the vast majority of people have no property, you know, personal possessions like houses accepted, you know, then they trade and we just keep the status quo going and going and going, okay? That's what I think this libertarian thing is really about. It is built on capitalism. It is built on the expropriation of the great mass of the people. Here's the point. Let's say that people did have their own individual property. Okay, would they be, you know, working for capitalists? Okay, or if you wanted to get something, would you have to not just hire them, would you have to cooperate with them in a community? Okay, you like capitalism, a lot of you, you know, because you're on the top of the system. Okay, and you think, okay, let's find some way to make it seem that this is just. But if people had their own individual property, they would not let themselves be exploited. Okay, maybe one out of whatever. But, you know, back 200 years ago when Australia was being founded, there was this guy, Mr. Peel. He brought all kinds of provisions. You know, he brought 300 working class people, men, women, and children, you know, with him, you know, to found this colony. You know, they'd be working for him in Australia. And what happened? They get there and they say, oh, cool, there's free land. We're out of here. You know, and he didn't have anybody to fetch his water. He didn't have anybody to do anything like that. Okay, so this is what I'm talking about. The system is really founded on people who have nothing, and they have to work for other people. Okay, this is not justice. This is not freedom for the vast majority of people. What do you want to do about it? Okay, how much more time do I have?
2.5 minutes.
2 minutes?
2.5.
2.5, okay. I am not in, you know, you heard that, like, I'm in favor of redistributing things by the sword. I'm not in favor of that. I've been criticizing that throughout this whole talk. How did the class of wage laborers and the class of capitalists who employ wage laborers, how did this get started? Precisely by redistribution by means of the sword. That's how it started. That's what it's built on. I'm not in favor of that. What, you know, but see, what goes on is, oh, let's, like, forget all that past, and given the starting point right now, assume that that's just, you know, and then, like, you know, anything that comes along is a violation, an infringement of this great freedom, which is built on the unfreedom of the vast majority of people. You know, come on, give me a break.
I'm sorry, 2.5 minutes now. Sorry.
I have 2.5 minutes now. Okay. Okay. Let me see what else I can deal with here. The vast majority of means of production are produced, sure. So we'll produce our means of production. I mean, even back in the 1500s, they produced means of production. How's that? Well, they raised chickens. And chickens hatch new, you know, eggs, and that becomes new chickens, and so forth. So that's, you're producing means of production like that. And they, you know, they produced their own tools and so forth. You know, they were able to innovate. You know, people are different. This is one of the things that I like about your writings and I like about libertarianism. People are different. So not everybody has to have the same motive in order to innovate. We have a lot of, like, you know, open software and this and that where people are contributing. It's not always like a profit motive that drives everybody. You know, so I think we're perfectly capable of innovating without that.
1 minute.
Okay. We hear that there are no economic laws specific to capitalism. In what other system did you even have profit? You would have something extra, but it wasn't profit. You might have interest.
Okay.
Where, in what other society do you have, as a dominant form, wage labor, where people have to sell themselves in order to survive? That's specific to capitalism. Economic crises prior to capitalism, were there large-scale economic crises such as occur and recur under capitalism? No. They would have famines, they would have floods.
Seconds.
Okay, stop.
Thank you.
And a huge thank you for our wonderful audience, both physically and online. A huge round of applause to you, too. You used your freedom to get here. So, well, this rounds off the debate. I'm here, and Ravi is also here from Marxist Humanist Initiative. If you like to ask more questions about Raya Donayevskaya and Marxist Humanism, you're very welcome to it. The bar is open a bit longer, I think, until 9:30 is what I've heard. Sophia, would you like to make a closing statement?
Actually, no. I think, I might add one thing. I think this debate and this evening has been super interesting, and I feel it's quite invigorating to actually have these kinds of discussions instead of engaging in discussions of, so to speak, stupid shit. And I'm super tired of having to discuss identity politics and post-socialism, not in the way you mean it, I guess. But
thank you.
So let's not do that, and let's get back to the basics.
We're meeting here. This is the day after the debate. To wrap up a few loose ends and hopefully to have a more relaxed back and forth discussion and not be confined to 15-minute talk limits or anything like that. And our hope is maybe to find some common ground and to hone down where the differences lie between libertarianism and Marxism, and between Professor Bieland's philosophy and politics and economics and Professor Kleiman's. What were your, now that it's the day after, what are your just general thoughts on the debate? And are there things that you wanted to have said but didn't have the time to, or were there things that confused you, or just, you know, general impressions?
I was pleased to see so many people turn out, and I learned that that's unusual, and I think it's a good thing that people are looking from outside of the standard constraints of politics and the standard lines of debate. Being a participant, and in particular, being in a debate with libertarianism, which uses a whole different language and comes at things from a whole different vantage point, it was very hard for me. So I was focused, very definitely on what I had to do. And I couldn't sort of like absorb the general scene. So I think the audience and the people viewing at home probably have a better feel for what happened than I did.
I think I share that view. And the structure of the debate sort of didn't help clarify either, because we started with 15 minutes each, sort of expressing our standpoints, our positions. And I think we were both cut off because we wanted to continue talking and explain some. I went through maybe 3/4 of the notes that I had, which left a bunch left to talk about after that. But then you had already responded, and then I wanted to respond to you. So we sort of started just going part of the distance, and then responding to our parts or partial arguments. I would have wanted to see a little more back and forth, to just for clarification, to show where we agree, because I think there is a lot that we do agree on, especially on the injustice of contemporary, whatever you want to call it, the system. And we have differences with respect to how to solve it, and also what a free society is about, which is the topic of the debate. So I think a little more back and forth would probably have helped, and maybe a little more time, but I mean, you can always give academics more time because they always need more time, right? Even if we had a month each, we'd probably still say that there was certain things that I didn't have time to say, right?
There are people like that. I tried to do it in 15 minutes. I mean, I think my opening remarks, maybe I went like 30 seconds over, but I got to the end of what I wanted to say. You can always go on, but what you need is a continuation of the debate more and more, so it would have been nice if it had gone on for 6 hours, but you can't do that. So maybe there's other ways in which the two of us or other people can be involved, maybe not in person, which is always exciting, but, there is Skype and so forth.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think both of us were representatives of sort of systems of thinking, systems of thought. So they're not really susceptible to just boiling it down to a one-liner. It's not party politics where you can just say, free stuff for my people or whatever it is they promise each other all the time. So we can't do that. We have to express.
I'm going to be putting out a line of expropriate the expropriators bumper stickers.
Well, I might actually buy one of those, but depending on the price. No, but I'm serious because in party politics on the news and whatnot, you have like 3 seconds and you need to get your message out. And then you get another 3 seconds and you need to use the same slogan. Because the only way of actually reaching people is to use the same slogan over and over and over again. Whereas what we were talking about were two very different perspectives. Yeah. And perspectives that usually do not get a place and do not get, well, definitely do not get time on air. And so we needed to start from scratch and explain the differences and the similarities.
I agree.
So what do you think those differences and similarities were?
Well, you know, I thought about this because during the debate, 2, maybe 3 times, Per said, Andrew is starting halfway in the middle, and I'm going to start from the beginning. I didn't know what that was a reference to. And I think thinking about it, I finally figured out what's involved. I'll tell you what I think. You were getting at. You can tell me whether I'm right or wrong. You start from a certain set of ethical principles. Then you say what procedures embody these ethical principles. And then you can get down to cases. Whereas I start from substantively what I want to see. And to me, that doesn't seem to be in the middle. It's just I'm starting from somewhere else. Is that what you would regard as correct?
Well, I think it is correct. I don't think that's what I was necessarily talking about during the debate. But I think you're absolutely right in that because we have different starting points in our argumentation. The problem I had was the discussion about the means of production. Maybe I don't understand you correctly about what you actually mean by the means of production, but to me, any means of production that is not pure labor or land, mm-hmm. virgin land, would be created. Mm-hmm. And that requires a long process. And it's also a path-dependent process where you build off of the capital that already exists and the means of production that already exist. Mm-hmm. And then saying that, well, we need individual property. Well, you also need to explain where this property comes from, where the means of production comes from, and how it is generated. And that's what I meant by halfway, because just saying that, okay, stop it right now and just divide it and then we'll continue.
Oh, okay. I'm actually not talking about dividing. I'm not talking about you know, dividing, right? I'm talking about that people have, or not that they do have, but we need to return to a situation in which people have the means of production that they need, you know, to make a living for themselves so that they don't have to go selling themselves, you know, to somebody and being under that somebody's control or else starve. Okay. But I mean the same thing by means of production that you mean. And yes, most means of production are themselves produced. So, but, you know, that passage from Marx that I read at the end of my opening remarks where he says the expropriators are expropriated and we're going to have a return to individual property, he said it's not a return to individual private property. That was his view. It's not going to be a return to individual private property, but it's going to be based on the land held in common and common ownership and control of the means of production. But the point is, individuals will own and control this. You know, the vast majority of people, you know, who are cut off from that right now, separated from any means of production of their own, any ability to gain a livelihood on their own, that will no longer be the case. That was what he was, I think, arguing there.
Okay, but how do you define that? Because that's what I'm struggling with. What is a livelihood? Is it just survival, or is it survival with an iPhone, or where do you draw the line? What exactly is individual property? Because you can't go back to it unless you know that. I mean, survival could mean just a bare minimum of calories and nothing more, right?
Right.
But you could also have a very productive society where we have buses and cars and iPhones and whatever.
Right.
And is that more than we need then, in your opinion? Or do we need that as well for a survival? I mean, what do you mean by that situation where we're satisfied, I suppose?
I'm not sure what you're asking me. Are you asking me, do I favor a, you know, high technology, high productivity, growing productivity society where we have more stuff, or to go back to, you know, previous agrarian low consumption time? Is that what you're asking?
I guess I'm asking what would be fair individual property?
Okay. Well, again, individual property does not mean private. Okay. So what does it mean fair? I'm not sure what you mean by what is fair individual property. I mean, look, no socialist that I know of has ever been against individual ownership and control of possessions, you know, and like, you know, you control your own toothbrush and nobody else does, you know, and you live in your own house if you want to live in a house, you know, or apartment or whatever. The issue has always been about the means of production as you define them. You know, should they be such that certain people can keep other people from using them? And that's all I'm saying is, no, everybody has to be able to have access to them, so that at whatever level of, you know, consumption they want to achieve, whatever rate of growth they want to achieve, they have these means of production available to them.
So does that mean then that you have the right to lose the means of production? Destroy them?
No.
But that means also that you cannot make any investments like an entrepreneur, because the future is uncertain. Maybe your investments are wrong, or they turn out to be wrong, or maybe it doesn't work out.
You're still thinking of private property, whereby you're excluding somebody from the property.
Well, you have to while you're using it.
No, actually not. Not if we're working in common.
But we're not in agreement with every investment that happens, right? Or do we need to be in agreement with every investment that we do as humankind? Or I don't understand, how do you achieve progress at all,
right,
in your society? I mean, that I guess that's the core of the question.
Okay. Well, I mean, in any society that you want to have like more stuff, you know, you want to build towards the future, not just have a stable level. I'm actually, you know, very open personally. I'm not Marx, okay? So maybe he wasn't open, and I'm more open to like the idea that we should, you know, have a, you know, simpler way of life. You know, if that's what people want, I don't have any real problem with that. But if people want to have, you know, continual economic growth, in any society, you got to decide, you know, are you going to consume more now or consume less now and devote resources to the future? I think that society can, you know, I mean, it's not that society makes a decision, but the individuals in the society can make a decision for the whole society.
But what does that mean in practice? I mean, I don't follow that leap.
Between what and what?
Between what you said about acting and then society. I mean, in order to use the means of production in a certain way, to invest them, you change them as well. You may combine them, in at least partially destroy some of them, right? In order to achieve something that you imagine would be valuable to others,
okay,
or yourself.
By destroy, you mean like you take wheat and you turn it into flour?
Also be building a new factory for a new type of good.
Oh, you tear down the previous factory.
Well, you tear down the previous factory, but you also you fix those resources in that factory, and maybe that factory turns out to be completely useless because people don't actually want what you produce.
Right.
Then then you have lowered the value of those means of production.
Oh, sure. I mean,
and they're stuck there until someone actually invests work to.
Yeah, I mean, whoever it is, whether it's private property or you know, communal property or whatever, you know, or just people working on their own, Robinson Crusoe. I mean, mistakes happen. Sure.
Yeah. Well, but I'm glad we agree on that. But I sort of thought you would agree on that. But that's the thing, because in a free market society, you would have private property of the means of production,
yeah.
Which means individuals in a decentralized fashion make these investments. But these investments are for profit, sure, but they're also tempered by the threat of loss. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's not just hot-headed.
Sure.
Whatever. But if it's communal property, doesn't that mean that the loss is actually distributed on everybody? So if I act using communal property.
Absolutely. It's a much bigger responsibility, you know, because you're not only screwing yourself over, you know, if you make a bad decision, you know, but everybody there, you know, we're all screwing ourselves over.
So what mechanisms do you have? Because then you have a society-wide moral hazard problem.
Can you see how is there a moral hazard? Because you're not passing the risk on to somebody else.
Well, you are, because all the opportunities that would have been there had you not fixed those resources in a certain type of production, you can't pursue those anymore because you've used those resources. I mean, the resources are scarce, right?
Yeah, sure.
So if I take 50% of all the resources, let's say, and I build a new factory to produce something that I think will be valuable. Maybe I asked community or whatnot.
Yeah.
And turns out that, no, people don't actually want that stuff, or it's the wrong color or something weird like that.
Yeah.
Then the value of those resources would be less. I mean, the use value of them.
Sure.
And then society will suffer because of that.
Sure. But, you know, you would not be initially taking that action on behalf of society, you know, as if, you know, without other people agreeing to it. I mean, if it's communal resources in some way, shape, or form, the community has to agree to this in the first place. So the community decides to take the risk, and the community decides then to bear the consequences.
So do you need then direct democracy or something like that to decide on what projects to pursue?
I'll tell you, I think it can probably be a mix. And I think you can have a plan without a planner at some level. You're going to need conscious planning probably at some level, but algorithms, you know, can be used, and a lot of information can be garnered through computers and so forth. Are you familiar with an idea by a couple of non-Marxists named Michael Abert and Robin Hanel, participatory economics, or PARICON?
No, I haven't heard that term anyway.
Okay, well, I'll just run through this briefly. This goes back to the socialist calculation debate. And, you know, somebody was able to show in a certain very stylized way that you could have supplies and demands balance if you had a free market with an auctioneer. And then in the 1920s or so forth, it was actually over a period of time, into the 30s, some people came along and said, well, you could do the same thing, get the supplies and demands to balance throughout society with a central planner. And then I guess in the 80s, whenever these guys did it, maybe the 90s with the participatory economics, they said, okay, so you got your auctioneer, or you guys got your central planner, but we don't like any of these. You can have a decentralized communal kind of process that does the same thing through iteration, trial and error, you know, by computer algorithms. You can get the supplies and demands to balance. And I kind of like that, because I'm very worried about bureaucracy. I'm very worried about, you know, some people having special knowledge and special control so they can rig, you know, the system. And if you don't have actual people running aspects of what you need to coordinate supplies and demands, the less you have of that, the better.
Well, I definitely like the algorithm example better than the central planner.
Yeah.
But it's still the case that in order to make supply and demand meet, we're still talking in the future, because production always takes time. Mm-hmm. And any production process takes a different amount of time than another production process. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking about the example by that the sort of solution that was offered by Taylor in 1929 about list prices, and sort of having central lists with prices. And then when shortages and surpluses arise, you just adjust the prices. And you could have an algorithm to do that. But the thing is that when you have a shortage or a surplus, it's already too late to adjust those processes. Yeah. And even if you adjust them accurately, when the new production actually is finished, well, you're going to have a different problem because preferences have changed and you have discovered new materials and new means of production
and
have developed.
And this, by the way,
so
is why the auctioneer thing is completely ridiculous, because the Valrasian auctioneer operates before anything takes place, and all decisions are made and all trades are made not only for like right now, but for the whole indefinite future of humanity. They're all made right now. So we have to know, you know, what we would be willing to pay for something that hasn't yet been invented, you know, or why would we pay? Well, because we're going to be dead, you know, hundreds of years, but we want to pass on an inheritance to, you know, and they're going to have this product, and we want to give them enough money to pay for this product. It's craziness. Okay. So, you can't do that, but you can perhaps do something 6 months, a year in advance, so that you're not trying to calibrate the supplies and the demands while the activity is going on, but ahead of time.
Well, I don't see how you can do that. I mean, I totally agree with you with the Valrasian auctioneer. I mean, that's why they have the assumption about perfect information, not about the present, but about eternity. If you have that, then you can solve the problem. No big deal. And that's what you do in neoclassical economics. It's an easy problem. It is a math problem. Right, because you know everything.
Sure, When you boil down the future into the present, you've solved all the problems of the world.
Yeah, and there's no uncertainty. So why bother with any of the real problems, really?
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, the thing is, with 6 months or 12 months, well, those could be pre and post the iPod, for instance, which changed people's behavior completely and their needs and wants and what they wanted to see and what they were looking for, right? So I don't think you can plan because you don't know what's going to happen. Or at least that's the case in the market system, where you have all these decentralized production decisions where entrepreneurs are competing for satisfying people's wants.
Well, you can plan. You can't be immediately responsive in such a situation.
Well, of course
you can plan. You know, so yeah, I mean, you don't know that the iPod is coming in 2 months, so you know you don't have a demand for iPods, and you know, right? But okay, you know, 6 months, a year, whatever it is, you're able to incorporate that. So you know, a little patience doesn't hurt.
Sure, but I mean, I'm not saying no one should ever plan.
Right.
I mean, I think it was Hayek. I'm not really a Hayekian, but I think Hayek said that, well, it's not about planning or not, but it's who plans. Like, is it a central planner, or is it a community planner, or is it each individual planning for himself? So it's not about planning or not.
Right.
It's about where does the planning take place. Is it the individual, or is it on a sort of aggregate level?
I think you need both. For instance, you know, if you want to talk about producing consumption goods, you need to know what the individual people want, because a lot of consumption, you know, is going to be individual. Okay, so you need to know that. When you talk about, like, work, you know, you definitely need, like, what kinds of work do people want to do? What are they willing to do? All kinds of questions like that. When it comes to investment, because you're talking about the allocation of society's resources, that needs to be thought of on the social or societal level. I was told last night that in Swedish, there's a big difference between social and societal. So it has to be on the societal level.
Yeah, but how do you do that? Because an individual entrepreneur can choose to bear the complete risk of a venture by not having any slack resources at all.
Yeah.
Investing 100% in this new thing that he or she thinks is the future, right?
Yeah.
And he or she will also bear the loss of that. Or he or she can choose to have a bunch of slack resources and say, well, okay, I'll just tweak this if it doesn't pan out.
Yeah.
But on a societal level, you don't have the trial error process. You don't have all these different decisions being made. So how do you choose how much of the resource, how much of the means of production to use as slack?
How does it differ for an individual and for a community?
There's only one decision maker for the community, and that's the problem.
Why is that? Why is there only one individual decision maker?
No, there's only one decision.
There's only one decision. Okay, sure. So in other words, in both cases, there are a range of options. And there is a decision that has to be made regarding what is the best from among those options. So either an individual makes it and bears the risks, or the community.
Yeah, but that's a simplified problem, because you might see a certain number of options that you can choose from. I might see a different number of options to choose from. Mm-hmm. And Martin might see a different number of options.
Right.
The question then is, how do we choose from these options? Well, they're subjectively assessed. Right. And I might believe in option two, which turns out to be a complete waste of resources. You might believe in a completely different option, and you're not really sure, so you just invest a little bit in that option and leave the rest as slack resources. If you have one decision for community, it's all or nothing.
Oh, I don't think a community has to do the look. Diversification is good. Okay, not putting all your eggs in one basket is good, and that has nothing to do with private property, you know, or communal property or anything like that. Okay, so I mean, I think it would be really dumb. I mean, if people in the future want to lock themselves into something very non-diversified, they can do that. I think it would be dumb.
So you just poll the community first to see what options they want to be considered?
No, I mean, I think you would need people.
I don't see the decision process.
You would need people who were involved in, you know, thinking through various options, getting opinions, soliciting them by all kinds of means. And now we've got really sophisticated big data ways of doing this that I know nothing about. Okay. And you come up with what you regard as a feasible set of options, and maybe there are, you know, people who think differently, so they would vote for like certain, you know, kinds of ways of thinking, and you get some sort of representation. You know, you might then just like say, okay, so we've narrowed it down to, you know, this, that, the other four or five things, you know, and you might take a referendum on that. Or you might do so by representative means, you know. I mean, let people figure it out. It's not my job to, like, you know, tell people how to live.
Yeah, sure. But how long does this process take? Because if you have private property, you decide over your property. You can take a long time if you want to, but you might actually lose the opportunity.
Sure.
Right? But if you poll the whole community, and then you have a referendum if you think it's necessary, and then you think about this other stuff.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's a really important point. And I think that you know, people will have to grapple with that. That if, you know, sometimes it's better to act, you know, not to delay things, even though, you know, you might make a somewhat better, more precise decision, you know, if you take your time. I mean, I face this every time I go shopping. You know, I can study, you know, all of the options and look at the unit cost of everything, you know, or I can just like, hey, my time is worth more than this, and grab something off the shelf. And I'm the kind of person who does the latter. So, you know, I like quicker action in some respects than, you know, being, quote, efficient. Because for me, efficiency is efficiency of time mostly.
Okay. But I mean, I can see how this would work if you hold people's wants and needs constant.
Yeah.
And they're satisfied to the same extent and in the same specificities, basically, throughout this decision process.
Yeah.
But in a market society, well, people change their minds. Mm-hmm. People satisfy a certain need, which gives rise to other needs. And then they just reevaluate their situation.
Yeah.
Which means when you start production now and when you finish it, even if it is tomorrow, consumers might behave completely differently.
Sure. This is the iPod issue all over again.
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
And my answer was, you know, a little patience doesn't hurt. So, you know, Like you all of a sudden, I mean, this is an actual example that I read whereby this philosopher, well, he calls himself a Marxist, but he thinks that like China today is a socialist society, market socialism.
So he's not a true Scotsman.
I'm kidding. He has a very different conception of what socialism is than I do. I think China is a state capitalist society, a market state capitalist capitalist society. But anyway, David Schweikert does not like this idea of participatory economics, and he goes, "Well, you know, this doesn't really work because, you know, hey, you know, every once in a while, you know, I want to fry a piece of bacon with my eggs, and you know, what about if I just like, gee, I want to eat an avocado? Well." Excuse me, you know, that kind of attention to your own whims and sacrificing the interest of all of us, you know, because you decide, gee, you know, I just cannot wait for this avocado or this occasional piece of bacon, you know, because all of a sudden, you know, it's like, I need to get it. So what am I going to do? I'm going to go bid up the price, you know, so I can get this piece of bacon. A little bit of patience doesn't hurt.
Okay, well, maybe you think so, but maybe there are really eager people, or maybe there are people who would die if they don't get this bacon. I mean, literally die, not just right. Say it. So what about those people? Or are you saying that, no, the community should be composed of individuals with the same time preference and the same sort of preferences?
No, I think that people need to understand. I mean, if it's not possible to have a society where everybody has their own means of production, you know, and we live with, you know, communal means of production, if it's not possible to have that, okay, and at the same time give David Schweikert his damn piece of bacon, then most of us come before his piece of bacon. You know, it's really important that people not have to either starve, you know, or, you know, subject themselves to the domination of one or another employer. That really, to my mind, is more important than his avocado when he wants it or a piece of bacon, you know. But this is only a question of how quickly these decisions can be, you know, drummed up, thought about, put into effect. Conceivably, if this is a big issue for society, people can devote resources to trying to speed up the process in ways that we haven't even imagined.
You mean if there's like a bacon riot or something like that, then...
I hope there wouldn't be a bacon riot, but I mean... people can say we want things to go quicker because we want to be more responsive to changes in our whims. Okay, fine.
I can see the argument if you have at least a relative abundance of the means of production and of resources, but if they're scarce or if you make them scarce through an investment, I don't quite see how you can do that with community decisions. So, for instance, if you dedicate a large portion of the resources to a very time-consuming or long production project, then you don't have a lot of resources left for other things. So can you make such a huge commitment in that type of community? Or would you never, do you think, I mean, in your opinion, do that simply because the risk is too great?
Well, I think I agree with the underlying point here is that your willingness and ability to put off present consumption for the sake of, you know, advances for the future depends on where you're starting from, you know. And so if you're starting from a low base, you want to make sure your immediate needs are met. And, you know, if you want this kind of economic growth society, as you grow, you're going to be willing to devote more resources towards building up the future. But yeah, it depends on where you're starting.
Right. And just for the record, I think we agree that large-scale, huge investments, as they're done today, would probably not be done in either of our societies. I mean, if I interpret you correctly, they probably would not be made in sort of community Marxist-based society. And I think in a free market, the markets would be a lot more decentralized and would be community-based as well, which means you would invest in very different things. You wouldn't actually have economies of scale to the extent that you do today, because the government or the state is actually subsidizing huge scale production, right, through free transportation, free roads, and things like that. So the production today is optimized for huge production, whereas in a free market where you don't actually extract wealth from some and give to others, you would have a smaller scale production.
Okay, this is very interesting because I've never heard from a certain camp that I think you represent a willingness to sacrifice efficiency. And that's exactly what I'm hearing right now.
I don't think that is what I'm saying, but I mean, one example that sort of seems to boggle people is if you look at the highway system and cars, and cars tend to be pretty fuel efficient around 60, 65 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And that's where the speed limit is, sort of, on most highways. But it's not the case that this is an objective universal law that an internal combustion engine is most efficient at 65 miles an hour.
Yeah.
It's rather that these engines have been optimized because the speed limit is there, right? And I think it's the same with production technology, that it has been optimized to sort of overproduce simply because transportation is so cheap and because these huge corporations don't have to bear their own costs. They can rather put those costs on taxpayers and smaller businesses.
But you did mention economies of scale, which means that it becomes cheaper to produce per unit the bigger the scale of production is.
And yeah, well, probably with some – I mean, there's probably some horizon to that. But I mean, it also depends on the optimization of the technology. And the optimization of the technology is skewed for the simple reason that transportation is over cheap.
Right, but let's take something like steel production. I mean, steel is produced at a lower cost per unit when you got big rolling mills and not backyard furnaces. Right. Okay. So, I mean, when I say community, I don't necessarily mean, 1,000 people, 5,000 people, could be a very large community. Now, I live in a city, New York City, where I personally it's just like I can't stand it. It's just way too many people all living together. But that's a personal preference. People might want to, keep doing that and have, the kinds of lives that we have now that are just, kind of very fluid, and you're kind of, in contact with everybody all at once, and the community doesn't have much of a community feeling. If that's what people want, so be it. I personally would prefer not to live like that. But I don't see any problems with large-scale production per se.
Yeah, me neither. I mean, the problem I'm seeing in society as it is today, or the economies as they are today, is the state. And because of the state, there is an implicit subsidy for really large-scale production.
I think you're saying that taxation, incentives, subsidies favor large-scale production, even when they would not be efficient otherwise.
Yes.
Okay.
Where they would not be economically efficient.
They
could be technologically efficient.
They could be technologically efficient. Okay. And what do you then mean by economically efficient?
Simply because very large-scale production as it is today might benefit from subsidies.
Yeah.
A good example would be railways that are already there, or roads that are built by government and so forth. Whereas in a free market, well, those roads would not be built by a government because there would be none.
Yeah.
And these businesses would have to cover that cost themselves, which would mean that it's probably cheaper to have smaller scale production in several places rather than just one big.
You mean the prices get skewed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, sorry for the confusion.
I don't translate. I mean, because, you know, there's like all kinds of meanings of efficiency in economics, and I didn't know like which one you were referring to.
Yeah, I forgot that we were two economists talking.
Yeah, you meant skewed prices. Okay, so where are we at here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we agree that there's at least some production in society as it is today is too large scale. And that those investments would not be made either in a free market society or a Marxist society. I think that's where we started out.
Last night I had problems, and I still have problems with talking about a Marxist society. It's not quite the – you can't describe a society by the name of a person, right? Or even the name of a body of thought.
Let's refer to it as Climania.
No, you're doing the same problem. I mean, it's the same problem. You're doing the same thing.
Yeah, but it's your vision of how it works.
Yeah, but it's a communal association, you know, of free individuals who have individual property. So, you know, we typically call it socialism. Problem is other people call other things socialism, so we've got a problem. But, you know, my shorthand term is socialism.
It's a popular term. It's a very popular term.
Yeah, everybody loves it, yeah. So, I mean, I really think this is a matter of individuals' preferences. What bothers me is when you've got, like, you know, an anarchic society. Moreover, then you lay on top of the anarchy, you know, the rigging of things by special interests, like, you know, people who get economic rents from governments. And you just, you know, you got nobody like deciding that this is going to happen. And you get, you know, this like urban sprawl and all these horrible problems arise and nobody's given it any thought.
But I agree with the problem. I'm not sure what an anarchic society with government subsidies would mean.
Well, you have the underlying anarchy whereby, you know, you got like individuals all making decisions in their self-interest and, you know, nobody is like coordinating this and you're leaving it to some alleged individual invisible hand. And then on top of this, you got the rigging and the special interest and the rent-seeking behavior. That just compounds the problem. Why can't we have a public discussion of this before any of that stuff gets done? You know, and like, gee, let's look at the consequences of this.
Well, I agree with that. Yeah. And I would say it doesn't compound the problem. It actually creates the problem. So maybe that's
because you probably believe in an invisible hand that.
Well, I've never seen one.
Right. That's why you have to believe in it. You know, otherwise it would just be a fact. I mean, what ensures that decentralized actions undertaken by individuals, you know, only concerned with themselves is even going to bring order?
Well, it necessarily will, simply because you benefit yourself by serving others, by producing for other people. If they don't want to buy what you produce, then you're screwed, because then you only have the cost.
How does this bring some order to society, though?
Why wouldn't it? I mean, what you're trying to escape is the narcissism and the egotistical sort of short-sighted views of these people, right? Who only think of themselves and so forth.
No. I'm just asking how. It's almost mind-boggling to the average person who has not suffered through several courses in economics to believe that everybody is doing their own thing, totally unconcerned with anybody else. They might like that. They might think it's ethically good. But it's really hard for people to think that order is spontaneously going to emerge from a process like this. Like, you know, the supplies and the demands will balance and people will be satisfied. It's really hard to believe that.
Yeah, but I don't think people are doing their own thing. They are interacting with each other all the time.
Yeah.
And they're exchanging things and they're exchanging ideas and they have joint ventures and so forth. And that's where the coordination emerges from, simply because we adapt to what there is and we find opportunities where there is not. And
Right.
We might
pursue those. So the upshot is that Marx got this right, where he says the order is the end result of the disorder. Okay.
In other words, the
story goes that, you know, the market mysteriously, spontaneously, by this invisible hand, creates order. That's not what happens. What happens is there's mistake after mistake after mistake, and they're continuously corrected. So it's just like with a doctor, you know, like doctors bury their mistakes. Well, that's what happens, you know, in capitalist markets, you know, like, okay, you know, you've got all these pigs and you're producing, you know, you're raising hogs, and all of a sudden there's the Great Depression. So how do you bring back supply and demand into balance? There's not demand. Well, you take a big pit and, you know, you shovel all the hogs into the pit. Or, you know, you got the Great Recession and you got all these workers and there's no need for them, you know, so they live on the dole if there is a dole, or they just starve to death. So you've brought back the supply of labor to the level of the demand for labor. That's not what I consider order.
Well, I don't think there is this sort of cycle to it either. And I don't think it is about making mistakes and then correcting the mistakes either. I think it's about acting and then figuring out whether there was a mistake or not and tweaking it along the way. And of course, if you make a mistake, you lose your capital, so someone else who didn't make a mistake gets more. So there is always this weeding out process of entrepreneurs and of the risk takers, which is where the order comes from, which is where progress comes from.
And have you disagreed with anything I said, or have you just made it sound good?
Well, you made it sound bad. That's why I stated in different terms.
Yeah, but I went first. So we're saying the same thing.
Well, I don't think we're saying exactly the same thing, because you see a cycle going back and forth. And
no, I don't necessarily think of a cycle, actually.
Okay, well,
I was just saying that there's an imbalance. More supplied than demanded, more demanded than supplied, and it gets corrected by burying the mistakes. You know, you kill off the workers, you kill off the hogs, whatever it might be.
I think that is a static view of it, because I don't think it is the case. Well, I don't think it is the case to begin with that we're actually in equilibrium at any time. So yes, there's a sort of a balancing, trying to figure out where to go, but that's not any person's decision. That's
right.
Just emerges. And the problem is that equilibrium moves every single second.
Sure.
Simply because we satisfy different wants and we start producing different things and
right.
We figure out new ways of using things. So you can't really say that we're ever in equilibrium and then we're pushed out or anything like
that.
No,
I'm not.
It's always a discovery process.
Yeah. I mean, if you knew anything about me, you would know that like I'm known as like a real non-equilibrium person. I don't think in equilibrium terms.
So it's just an accusation.
So when I say supply is brought back in balance with demand, I mean as a tendential process, as a tendency, not that it actually like ever reaches that point exactly.
Right. And I think that is a process that has been going on for thousands of years and will continue to go on forever, probably, unless we end up in Star Trek world. For the simple reason that there are more people, there are more resources discovered, and I don't mean natural resources, but economic resources. There are more goods innovated and produced, and people change their behaviors, which gives rise to new behaviors and new wants and new needs. And that means that equilibrium is always something that we as an economy or we as a community can aim for in the future, but we will never ever reach it. It's a moving target.
Absolutely agreed.
I mean, to refer to Hayek again, I mean, the market is a process and it's really a discovery process.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're figuring out along the way how we can use resources in better and better ways.
Right.
And we're figuring out, what that really means, better ways, is to be able to satisfy more wants and more people's wants.
Right.
And more highly cherished ones as well.
You seem surprised that I agree. You seem to think like I'm a neoclassical economist or something.
No, I mean, and I would say that Austrian economics, which I would represent, is probably the only, or at least one of the two, or something like that, of the remaining classical economic schools. right? Even though it's based off of marginalism and so forth. Yeah. But it's the same type of reasoning. And I mean, Marx was in that era as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I can definitely see that. And I mean, in my theory of the firm, I based it partly on Marx, though I didn't follow at all when he sort of followed a tangent into exploitation. But his identification of the division of labor within the firm, as opposed to in the market, was absolutely correct. So, I mean, I'm building off of that. So I see a lot of good things in Marx. I just don't see the society.
I listened to your lecture. You gave a lecture at the Mises School or Institute on this. I listened to that, yeah.
What did you disagree with? Because that would be interesting to hear.
Well, the swipe at Marx for about exploitation. But I mean that, you know, you can't talk about that without going back to a lot of theoretical building blocks.
Sure, and I mean, what I did was Marx, like everybody else at that time, just assumed what Adam Smith said about the division of labor and specialization, right?
Yeah,
and everybody did back then.
What, that it's limited by the extent of the market?
Well, that and that it exists. And I think Marx was the person to most explicitly state that division of labor goes further within an organization than outside of it.
Right. But Marx also, Marx understood division of labor and manufacture, hand production, as a stage in the development of capitalist production. And then he talked about machinofacture or the modern factory, you know. And he said that very detailed technical division of labor, you know, of like Adam Smith's pen factory, that gets overthrown with machinofacture.
Okay, in what sense?
You no longer have, you know, 19 or so people, you know, one pulls out the wire, you know, another straightens it, another cuts it. You got a machine that does everything, and you got a person, you know, who's an appendage to the machine.
I like the random example.
Yeah. Why try to invent a new example, right?
Well, true. But I mean, there's specialization and division of labor in producing the machine.
Oh, of course. But then even those kinds of processes tend to be mechanized as well.
Yeah, of course. But someone still has to mechanize them.
Oh, and, sure. Yeah, I mean, Marx didn't say, like, all throughout society, every production process is characterized by, you know, how he understood machinofacture. So, I mean, first of all, I mean, Marx says the capitalist production basically begins with simple cooperation, just drawing people together to work. And before that, like... Actually, capitalism begins before capitalist production with the so-called putting out system, where you had people supplying people raw materials that they would work up, and then they would sell the product to that person. So it was called the putting out system, and they did textiles that way. But then the workers are brought together. Then you get a later stage where you've got this division of labor and, you know, very fine division of labor. Then you've got machine production. But actually in society right now, you got all of these different processes still operating.
So what happens? I'm curious, but what happens after this phase of post division of labor with the machines?
I don't know. You know as well as I do, you live in the same society.
Right, but I thought maybe Marx had an idea of what would follow.
I think Marx thinks that we have to... Now, Emmanuel is tapping his wrist to indicate that we have to wrap up.
Okay, let's wrap up.
I don't think Marx talked about it. Yeah.